Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
The story I'm about to tell you is a cautionary tale. In October 2004, I made an appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno to promote my book on presidential pets.
Mo, come out here. Mo Rockley.
But it's not my appearance on the show that I regret. It's what happened next. After the taping, I went back to my hotel in Universal City. I hadn't eaten dinner, and the hotel restaurant was offering a seafood buffet. I can still see it now, a sort of banquet table with tiers of crab legs. I'm pretty sure there were oysters. And dominating the landscape, a mountain of shrimp, a glistening pink pyramid. How could I resist? By the time I was done that evening, that bounty of shrimp was less of a pyramid and more of a mound. The next morning, I flew back east, happy as a, well, clam. But somewhere over the Midwest, I started experiencing turbulence. An inner turbulence. The choppiness subsided only after 36 hours, in and out of bed. And I knew what was to blame for my condition.
Until that point in my life, I was pro-buffet. And I thought, I can't believe that I did that. Everyone was exhaling on the shrimp. And I don't want to eat other people's exhale.
Right. But probably that came from bad shrimp, not a human breath.
It could have been other shrimp's breath.
I mean, let's talk about that.
Everyone can name something they'd like to see vanished from the earth. I'm guessing famine, disease, war top most lists. But what are the things just below those that you wish would disappear? Me? I have at least three, one of which made the list that very night in 2004.
That kind of buffet, the sticky tongs and the, you know, you see somebody who just like dug around to the back of the macaroni and cheese tray to get like the very best in the back. And then it's all kind of grotted out and it's warm. Oh. And yeah.
The second thing on my list? Well, I've never complained when an audience has applauded me like they did that night on Leno. But there's a certain kind of intense, exaggerated reaction that over the last few years has become all but meaningless.
Standing ovations are a bit like an avalanche. One person stands, and then a few other people think, oh, well, I guess we're standing.
And please don't make me raise my voice to tell you about the third thing on my list that really works my nerves.
It's a blight on any neighborhood. It's war without our permission.
On this podcast, we've paid tribute to beloved entertainers and courageous change makers, sitcom characters gone without a trace, even iconic college campus trees, people and things that deserve to live on in the collective memory. But today, I want to talk about three things that I really just wish would die already. From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, things I wish would die. Buffets, standing ovations, and noise.
I was looking at this video of a clan of hyenas feasting on an elephant carcass. And I thought, is there something in our nature that makes us want to gather around this trough of food and just go for it?
Remind me not to go out to dinner with you, Mo, but is there an animalistic nature to eating at a buffet? Probably. Certainly at some of the buffets I saw, there is that.
That's Kim Severson. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes about food and culture for the New York Times. She's written about the unexpected comeback of the buffet.
Let me ask you, didn't we think the pandemic would kill buffets?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the surprise of the post-pandemic era. I just thought they would never come back.
Buffets did get creamed early in the pandemic, but the Golden Corral chain says their business shot back up 20% between 2021 and 2022.
Maybe the fact that people had to be so distant from their food and other people, they've overcompensated by really going hardcore on the buffet. They're like, damn it, I just want to get my prime rib and my all-you-can-eat crab.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just don't want whooping cough with my Waldorf salad.
Okay, I can hear a lot of you saying, what is Mo's problem with buffets? So let me be clear. What makes me uneasy are the entirely self-serve buffets. They're sometimes known as hot open food bars, where there is no one standing between the food and the mob. No food professionals on active duty. That irks me because, let's face it, people, myself included, revert to our natural state when there's not a lady in a hairnet brandishing a ladle and glaring at us to mind our manners.
And some people actually take little tastes along the way with their fingers.
Oh,
they do. Oh, Mo, I'm so sorry. Do you need a minute?
This is the only interview where I've needed a spit bucket.
I'm so sorry.
Am I being totally rational here? Of course I'm not. Plenty of full-service restaurants, even very popular ones, have food safety issues. But when I'm holding a pair of sticky tongs that 100 other strangers have touched and looking at a bin of gloopy mystery meat, I start imagining things.
The look, that glistening look of congealed meat. It's not about the taste or even the smell, but it almost looks like what I imagined the La Brea tar pits look like.
And it's really just Salisbury steak, but how do you know? You don't know.
Of course, buffets are probably as old as those tar pits.
When in human history do self-serve buffets emerge?
We have to imagine that there have always been occasions in which a lot of food would be cooked and put out and people would eat it. But I think as a formal style of restaurant eating, we can go to Sweden and the smorgasbord. Sweden hosted the Olympics in 1912, and everybody was so thrilled that they had this thing called smorgasbord that you could just go and help yourself.
Now, the smorgasbord wasn't for pigging out. Originally, for the upper classes, it was more of a refined spread, typically composed of cheeses, cured meats, fish like herring, flatbreads, and sweets. You might remember us mentioning the smorgasbord earlier this season in the Jim Thorpe episode. He triumphed at those 1912 games. You might also remember the smorgasbord from The Muppet Show.
Mork, 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 Miss Virgil.
They're going to get that Swedish chef someday.
Who is?
The smorgasbord of health.
Anyway, the smorgasbord made a splash on American shores at the 1939 World's Fair in New York City. Visitors were reportedly spellbound by the vast rotating table festooned with Swedish delicacies. It was basically a giant Lazy Susan, and who doesn't love a Lazy Susan? But how did that evolve into the buffet as we know it today?
Well, it takes root, as this will not come as a surprise to people, but in Las Vegas in the 40s, and there was this idea that somehow we've got to keep people inside the casino.
The story goes that a man named Herb McDonald, the publicist for the El Rancho Vegas Casino, was working late one night when he began feeling peckish. He grabbed some cheeses and cold cuts from the kitchen and laid them out on the bar to make a sandwich. When some hungry gamblers asked to partake, Herb had an idea. And in 1946, he debuted his Buckaroo Buffet, an all-you-can-eat buffet for $1.
This idea that you could keep gamblers in your casino started off with just some sandwiches, and then it became all you can eat and everything you want, and you never have to leave the casino. And they were very cheap. They were loss leaders and remained loss leaders in Vegas for a long time until the celebrity chef era happened.
By the 1980s, buffets had spread across the country. They were featured on cruise ships and in fast food chains like Pizza Hut.
So if you want the whole hut and nothing but, you know what to do. Hit the Hut
Buffet! Fine dining restaurants embraced them. My first fancy buffet was at a hotel on Easter Sunday. The buffet, it turned out, was a manifestation of American values.
Americans love excess, right? We love big things. We love choice. And the buffets are the perfect example of that, right?
You mentioned choice, and I want to play a piece of a promotional video for Sizzler that was produced in 1991.
All across America, the song of freedom rings. The song is growing stronger every day.
So this video is about 5 minutes long. It's heavy on Americana. There's a smiling construction worker, a little girl swinging a baseball bat, a golden retriever catching a frisbee. It feels like a campaign ad.
Sizzler brings the choices that you've been looking for. In giving you the right to choose, we're offering much more.
And then the requisite key change as the jingle swells into a Sizzler anthem. There are golden huge shots of couples and families dining. They aren't simply happy, they're in ecstasy. Some of them might actually be on ecstasy. A woman is maniacally licking her lips. A couple begins making out at the Sizzler. That's what the freedom and choice of a buffet will do to you.
Unbelievable. How fabulous is that?
I keep thinking like, oh my God, did I remember to register to vote? Like it feels very...
That's right. It's right. It's Don't Stop Believing, but a buffet commercial, you know?
The video may be over the top, but Kim points out that the buffet restaurant really is more than just a place to eat.
I love them and I also can't stand them at the same time, but the buffet became such a piece of cultural currency for kids and they can still remember when their families were going to celebrate something, they would all go to the hometown buffet because you could feel celebratory and it wasn't going to cost a lot of money. And also for kids who were second generation, or their parents were immigrants, the buffet became kind of a roadmap for how to eat in America. And I think for those parents, it was like, okay, we're going to go learn to eat whatever the American food is here. Good friend of mine whose parents came from Taiwan and she was raised in Ohio by these first gen immigrants. The day they all got their green cards, they went to the buffet to celebrate.
Now, I appreciate all of this. And lest you, the listener, think I'm a killjoy or curmudgeon, I want to make one point very clear.
I want to draw a distinction between cafeterias and buffets. I am very pro-cafeteria.
Really? Okay. Okay. What's the difference to you then?
A cafeteria to me is where you have someone policing the situation. So I loved growing up. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. There was something called Hot Shops Cafeteria.
And at Hot Shops, we cook our chicken so they're always tender, juicy, and delicious.
And I have fond memories of grabbing my tray, feeling so empowered, going along the line, the carving station with the side of roast beef, the individually plated slices of lemon meringue pie. I felt safe and I felt secure because there were people with plastic gloves and hairnets on the other side. And even if I could grab something on my own, I knew that there was a watchful eye. And I feel like the buffet, on the other hand, is small-d democracy brought to its extreme. I'm not saying that I want a cafeteria police state. I'm not saying that. I think the key to it with the cafeteria is that everything was individually plated. That's why I really respond to that.
And there's a cleanliness factor for sure.
I'm sorry, I just don't want tuberculosis with my chicken tetrazzini. Ultimately, I'm grateful to live at a time and in a country with buffets and cafeterias, because no one wants to be told what they can and can't eat.
You're a perfect example of that in a way, right? You know what you want and what you don't want and what you will eat and what you won't eat. And
well, I know one thing. I don't want hepatitis with my hash browns.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
A final word. The producer of this episode tells me she now has serious second thoughts about eating at her workplace's open food bar. You're welcome, Liz. On the other side of the break.
Woo! Woo! Sing the trolley song again. Yes, queen.
Yes!
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you remember your first standing ovation?
I'll never forget my first standing ovation.
This is my friend Eric Neer. You might remember him from our episode on Fanny Bryce. Eric's a culture critic with the Hudson Review, and he's back to talk about the second thing I wish would die, the obligatory standing ovation.
It was Liza Minnelli in concert at the Erie Crown Theater in Chicago around 1980. I was a teenager who had seen the movie Cabaret about six times, and at the end of the concert, everybody stood, and I thought to myself, oh my God, she was so amazing that she literally forced people onto their feet as if she levitated them out of their seats. I had never seen something like that before.
Okay, first of all, it's apparent that you were exactly the right person to bring in here to talk about this because you have this memory from over 40 years ago.
Right.
So, what was motivating you to stand up? Was it her performance or everybody else standing?
It was everybody else standing because I didn't know that was a thing that you could do at the time. But I hadn't seen a lot of theater other than community theater and that kind of thing, and no one stood at the Stagecoach Players. But back in the 70s, people didn't really stand, even if they loved the show. There were exceptions, but it required a certain kind of performance and a certain kind of performer to get people on their feet. That, of course, is now all changed.
It certainly has changed. Today, a standing ovation at the end of a theatrical performance or at an awards show has become almost routine. It wasn't so long ago that a standing ovation was extraordinary.
And let it be said that number 8, Cal Ripken Jr., has reached the unreachable star.
The unreachable star is a reference to The Impossible Dream from the musical Man of La Mancha. But this standing ovation in 1995 wasn't in a theater. It was in a ballpark for Baltimore Orioles player Cal Ripken Jr. He'd just broken Lou Gehrig's record for playing the most consecutive Major League Baseball games ever, 2,131 to be exact. I remember when this happened, and trust me, you don't have to be a baseball fan to watch tape of this and be moved by the show of respect and admiration for a man who'd shown such devotion to his livelihood. The ovation was completely organic, and at 22 minutes, yep, 22 minutes, it was the longest known standing ovation in American public life. Contrast this with a standing ovation a decade later that matched the 22-minute Ripken record. In 2006, the audience at the Cannes Film Festival in France applauded for about that long after a screening of the movie Pan's Labyrinth. But the director, Guillermo del Toro, seemed less flattered and more confused by the reaction.
It lasted long enough that I didn't know what to do.
This standing ovation, like so many at Cannes, felt unfelt.
So I think what happened at Cannes is something that also we could maybe say has happened in the theater, and that is that there's a certain aspect of standing ovations that are performative, where the audience wants to prove to everyone around them that they are appreciating what's happening and are sort of part of the experience.
No doubt, audiences of the past would be mystified by audiences of today, and vice versa.
We would probably look at audience behavior 150 or 200 years ago, let alone 500 or 2,000 years ago, and not recognize what was being done. There's so much we don't know about Greek theater, but we get a sense from contemporary descriptions that there was an intense identification between the audience and what was happening on stage. So there would be a lot of sort of expressive reaction, crying, wailing, shouting, and so forth.
Wailing and shouting?
Right, you know, because these were very tragic stories often being told, or else riotous laughter at the comedies.
Right.
But we don't have any sense of whether people stood at the end or not. There's no document of that kind of thing. Remember, in Shakespeare's time, most of the audience stood for the entire performance, so a standing ovation would have been redundant.
Oh, my goodness. God, it's sort of crazy, though, to think. I mean, I know it would have been redundant, but, you know, that Julius Caesar didn't get a standing ovation, and the Gloria Estefan musical On Your Feet got a standing ovation, which, by the way, I liked. I actually really liked it. Do you think they, by the way, do you think they titled it On Your Feet to get people on their feet?
It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It wasn't until the 18th century that audiences began even clapping in a theater. Around this time in Italy, opera fans probably began standing for exceptional performances. Theater historians tend to agree that the standing ovation emerged in its current form on Broadway in the years after World War II.
So what happens in the 1960s, and I have to reference our friend Ethan Morden here, who has written about this quite a bit, There's a new phenomenon of what we might call the big lady shows, where musicals in particular are built around specific star performers. And the early examples of that are, of course, shows like Hello, Dolly! Or MAME, where we see a phenomenon of people buying tickets because you have to see Carol Channing in Hello, Dolly! Or you have to see Angela Lansbury in MAME. Open a new
In the years before these big lady shows, the curtain call, that's when performers take their bows, was short and to the point.
Up through the 1950s, even shows like My Fair Lady that were massive hits, there's about 2.5 minutes of curtain call music, which means that everybody came on, the leads took a few solo bows, and everybody got off pretty quickly.
There's not enough time to stand up for Julie Andrews and Richard Burton and Robert Goulet and
in
Camelot, say.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But by the time you get to Hello, Dolly!, there's a fully staged curtain call, and this is something that the director, Gower Champion, really wanted to do. It's not just everybody shuffle on, bow, 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 shuffle off. It's a choreographed curtain call with music that is deliberately written to build the tension up until the moment that Carol Channing comes down those stairs one more time for that final bow.
Producers began doing what they could to guarantee a standing ovation.
And I actually know this because we have a mutual friend, Bart, who was hired straight out of college by the producers of the Hello, Dolly! Revival in 1995.
With Carol Channing.
With Carol Channing, her final Dolly performances, to sit in the second row at every single performance and start the standing ovation at the end.
So he was a plant.
He was a plant. He stood, and then it becomes a cascading phenomenon, right, which standing ovations are a bit like an avalanche.
Quick sidebar. Along with ovation inflation has come a new way of vocalizing appreciation for a performance. No more bravo or encore. Now, no matter what kind of show you're seeing, you're likely to hear woo!
The woo is a fairly recent phenomenon.
And it's horrible. I mean, it is just awful. The woo phenomenon, it's a scourge.
I think the woo phenomenon is something that comes from audiences who attend as much pop music as they do theater these days, and they've brought that sensibility into the theater.
Not long ago, Eric went to a performance of a small chamber musical, serious in tone, and still...
there was a significant portion of the audience, and I'm gonna stereotype them as being people under the age of 30, who were wooing or even saying, yes, in the middle of the numbers being performed.
Like a Yaz Queen kind of thing?
Right, yeah. Or, you know, sing it, that kind of thing.
You're kidding me.
Right. And let me clarify that I in no way endorse wooing during the performance of the song. After the singer has finished, wooing is acceptable to me, but wooing a high note in the middle of the song, I do find obnoxious.
Oh, wooing a high note? That's horrendous to do that.
Now let's venture beyond theater. On television, the Oscars are a handy barometer of how commonplace standing ovations have become. I still remember the 1985 Oscars telecast, when Jack Lemmon introduced Lord Laurence Olivier to present the Best Picture winner. Olivier wasn't receiving an award, but his very presence brought the crowd to its feet. Olivier himself was overcome and forgot to name the nominees.
And the winner for this is Amadeus.
Nowadays, of course, it seems like there's usually about 6 or 7 standing ovations at each Oscar ceremony.
Will Smith got a standing ovation after he hit someone.
After he did, indeed. And I sort of feel like, you know, the appreciation is the award. You don't need the standing ovation as well. You're holding an Oscar in your hand. That's the win.
To me, the corollary to the standing ovation is the exclamation point and the use of it.
That is something that is certainly a factor of our digital age, that I became really aware of how often I was using exclamation points in emails.
But it's an arms race, and I don't, like, you're great. Next time I email you, I don't want to not use an exclamation point because I would worry that you think I'm upset at you or for something.
That's right. The exclamation point is the new period. And the double exclamation point is the new exclamation point. You have to use 2 or 3 now to indicate that you really are exclaiming this and not just stating it.
What can we do about this?
That rock has started to roll down the hill and there's no way to get it to stop, I think.
Likewise, there may be no standing up to the standing ovation.
Times change, and the way we express appreciation evolves with time. And so we're at a stage now where the standing ovation is obligatory, and we can choose to fight that or just to accept it. And I've come to a place of acceptance. I don't love it in my heart, but I accept it with my brain.
You've opened my mind, though.
Okay.
But I'll never be okay with wooing.
Mo, this was amazing. Woo!
Coming up, it's gonna get a little loud.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, there. I'm on the number 2 train headed uptown right now. I sent you an email, which I'm sure you received.
It's no surprise that New York City, the city I call home, is a noisy place.
This is my peaceful walk to work.
So it should come as no surprise that the third thing I'd like to die is noise. Maybe it's getting older, maybe it's my tinnitus, that ringing in my ears, but more and more I value quiet. Honestly, if the library opened a restaurant, I'd be the first to make a reservation. But I also realize that noise is subjective.
I don't think there's a universal definition of noise. It depends on where you are, who you are, and when you're doing the listening.
That's Mark Smith. He's a history professor at the University of South Carolina, where he specializes in something called sensory history. He teaches his students not just what the past looked like, but what it smelled, tasted, and sounded like. And oh, how I wish I'd been able to take his course when I was in college.
Okay, so sound is often associated as a positive thing, right? Noise is considered to be sound out of time. That is to say, something that you could hear during the day happens at 2 o'clock in the morning and it suddenly becomes noise. And that's what noise ordinances are usually about.
Now, there's nothing new about people grumbling about noise, and we've got 7 decades of CBS News archives to prove it. There's the burglar alarm in Maryland that went off for 5 days.
I'm taking 800 milligrams of Motrin. That puts me right to sleep because you hear it constantly.
And the New Orleans jazz residents who sued their city for, get this, loud street jazz.
Just imagine your own house. You wake up and there's a large brass band out there and it's there every day, 8 to 10 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Back in the 80s, when boomboxes were booming, there was the campaign for radio-free zones in New York.
There are fines for violators up to $50.
Well, I've been coming here every day with my radio, man, my tapes. Santana's greatest hits, you know, it's like, can't even play it, man.
And later on, the valiant fight against leaf blowers in Northern California.
It's a blight on any neighborhood. It's war without our permission.
Quick aside, that voice you just heard is Julie Newmar, TV's original Catwoman.
This is my night to howl, Batman.
Because tonight you are the mice and I am the cat.
And then there's the Virginia dog, who was sentenced to death for barking.
It was just bark, 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 bark.
I don't believe it. That's the CBS Evening News for this Friday. Dan Rather reporting from New York and hoping you have a good weekend.
Don't worry, the ruling was overturned. And Max went free. But what do we know about what kept people awake before sound recorded history?
I suspect for most of human history, the loudest noise before the modern era that anybody would have heard would have been thunder.
That's Mark Smith again, our sensory historian. I asked him to take us back in time. What about the sounds that the early settlers in America from Europe heard?
So bells, for example, can be found in the earliest colonial villages. And those bells are marking Western civilization as they hear it on to this new world. But beyond the physical limits of that township or that village was a howling wilderness known as the Rant. This is a place yet to be discovered. This is a place to be feared. This is a place to retreat from or impose your will over.
Okay, well, the howling wilderness that you're describing sounds terrifying. It sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, first of all. Like, they're just like that this border territory between their probably very small villages at this point and the vast unknown. Is it wind? Is it animals? What is it that they're hearing?
Well, it's all of the above. The topography of the place is quite different to many European countries, right? When you go to a place, you make comparisons, and that comparison is going to be inevitably hostage to the time that you make it. So, for example, tornadoes existed in colonial America, right, when these settlers were first arriving. But they couldn't possibly say that those tornadoes sounded like a freight train, could they?
Did they say it sounded like Satan?
It's demonic, but it could also be the wrath of God. It must have been absolutely unnerving at a very deep emotional level to hear what America sounded like.
When trains did begin crisscrossing the country in the 1820s and 30s, the sounds were just as startling as thunder.
People didn't quite know what to make of them. I mean, here you have a sound of movement cutting through the countryside. And it's terrifying at first for some people. Like, what is that? And then when the whistle goes off, it's unnerving. But very quickly, people begin to embrace that sound as a kind of progress. And then after that, the sound of a train becomes quickly incorporated into the fabric of American nostalgia, especially a steam engine.
So it goes from scary to a sign of progress to something almost romantic.
I think so. I think that's the point, yes. This is an example of attaching meaning that changes over time. When we hear bells today, we think of them as quaint, right? They kind of rally people to church, but they didn't always sound quaint to certain people. And if you're an enslaved person on a southern plantation, a bell has nothing quaint about it. It is the sound of labor. It is the sound of obedience. It is the sound of surrender. There is no standard definition of the meaning of a bell. It's very much who you are.
In the late 1890s, urban development made cities very loud places. In response, a new progressive movement took shape. One of its targets? Noise. Reformers made the case that loud noises were bad for the nervous system.
I think probably the most powerful expression of this comes during the First World War, where you have people who are, in fact, not just deafened, but psychologically damaged by not just what they see, not just what they smell, but what they hear in that war. And obviously, it's the screams of your compatriots being shot, but it's also the unprecedented volume of munitions going off. Nobody had heard noises that loud before.
Got to be in a trench in World War I, and the sounds you must have heard.
You see, you hear the shell before it hits, and that's what you're hearing is possible imminent death.
The 20th century gave rise to sounds that today we take for granted. The first automobiles were very noisy, and then we took to the skies.
Planes flying over our area is a thing that people have gotten to a point to where children wake up in the middle of the night screaming.
That's from a 1962 CBS News special. Host Walter Cronkite interviewed then Federal Aviation Chief Najib Halaby.
Would you say, Mr. Halaby, that we're just going to have to learn to live with the noise of the jet age?
Well, you know, we've always learned to live with noise. The automobile, which was a frightening-looking machine making a terrible noise when it first appeared. Certainly, the construction noise of a pneumatic hammer is much higher than that of a distant jet airplane or a helicopter. So I think one of the prices of progress and power is going to be a level of noise. If it's dangerous to health and life, it should not be tolerated. But if it's just irritable, I'm afraid that's one of the prices of so-called progress.
The balance between progress and noise pollution was tested as never before by the introduction of the Concorde. Riding on it was the height of luxury. Living under its flight path wasn't so pleasant. That sound you just heard is sonic boom.
We have in our archives, I only just watched it, a CBS News report from 1970 from Wales about the Concorde, and the sonic boom of the Concorde disturbs one elderly woman because it reminds her of the bombing during World War II.
It was like a bomb going off, a blast, and it shook me up. And I was very frightened because I was bombed in the war.
Then when a young woman, she sounds like a teenager, actually a girl, is interviewed, she says, it was a little scary at first, and now she loves it because it's really, really cool because it's associated, my God, with a supersonic jet.
Well, I was only frightened the first time. I wasn't frightened the second time.
Do you think the Concorde should go on flying over here?
Yes.
You like the Concorde?
Yes. nice fast plane. One.
Yeah, that's a perfect example because the child doesn't have the memory of the war. If you experience the Second World War, how you understand sounds during it and after it are going to be really different as opposed to being born in the 1980s or 1990s.
The U.S. government limited Concorde service after cities issued numerous noise complaints. As for the sounds of today,
any advice on how I should think about that jackhammer on the way to work?
Let's imagine that there are no jackhammers. Think about the state of your streets and your roads. Unless we develop a technology that's quieter to repair the roads, then you're going to have to deal with it. So, Mo, I would say this. Go around the block a different way, perhaps, or just recognize that the street is better for that temporary engagement with noise that you had to endure, as unpleasant as it is.
But there are certain sounds that are just noise. The dirt bikes, the illegal ATVs that roar up 6th Avenue in the middle of the night and wake me up. I cannot find the upside. I can't find a way of redefining those noises.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you, and that's probably why there's a noise ordinance prohibiting it, right? However, to the person riding the ATV or the dirt bike, this is the sound of protest. This is the sound of youth. This is the sound of whatever they think it is. Now, they might be in a distinct minority, but that's kind of the point about the context, right? And who's doing the listening and who has the authority to say, no, that's noise.
Jackhammers, good. Illegal dirt bikes, bad.
Fair enough.
I get it. One person's noise is another person's music. Likewise, one person's steaming, gurgling bin of cooties is another person's buffet. Just as one person's coerced standing ovation is another person's inspired, authentic, and spontaneous woo fest. It's all about context and changing mores. And look, I'm willing to go with the flow. So don't be surprised to see me at your favorite hard-rocking, all-you-can-eat joint. I'll be the one wiping down the tongs. I certainly hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram. And you could follow me on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, at Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries' Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, now available in paperback and audiobook. It includes plenty of stories not in the podcast. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Liz Sanchez, who wishes hiking with loud music would die. Our team of producers also includes Chloe Chobel, who wishes the girl boss mentality would die, and me, Moraka, with engineering by Josh Hahn, who wishes parachute pants would die. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson, who wishes gender reveal parties would die. Yes. And fact-checking from Annie Cronenberg, who wishes elaborate bachelorette trips would die. Mobituary's production company is Neon Hum Media. Indispensable support from Alan Peng, who wishes asparagus soda, yes, asparagus soda, would die. Yes. And everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Steve Razies, Rand Morrison, and Alberto Robina. Executive producers for Mobituaries include Megan Marcus, who wishes espresso martinis would die. Yes, Jonathan Hirsch, who wishes judging other people's vocal fry would die. And me, Mo Rocca. The series is created by yours truly. And well, you already heard what I wish would die.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.